This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
For this felony, Crime Stoppers is offering up to a $5,000 reward. Call 713-222-TIPS. KPFT will continue to broadcast the programming you enjoy and will always be Radio for Peace. I'm Dwayne Bradley, and this is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Falinski.
And Jennifer Renee.
Deborah Bell.
And Glenn Holt.
Tonight on the show, we're going to be talking to Jackie Ware, volunteer coordinator for Thomas Street Community Health Services. She'll be discussing volunteerism and also addressing the current issue of the syphilis outbreak in Harris County, which has reached epidemic portions, and the history of Thomas Street and its evolving volunteer program. Then we'll also be playing a Remembering Stonewall segment, and I forget exactly where that came from. I guess that came
from the vault.
The vault.
Yes.
The vault.
The archives.
And, of course, all of our wonderful stuff from This Way Out. And we're getting through this hot season here in Houston, but thankfully we don't have a hurricane beating down our
path. No, but there's
Dean's not coming to town
not
after
Dean,
all, it looks
there's
like.
Another one, like, on its tail.
Well,
know?
Good.
Elizabeth
so,
or something?
Yeah. So we can just, you know.
Yeah, the news can then do wall to wall, even if it doesn't show up.
That's
here.
Right.
You mean the water I bought, I can still use?
They'll tell us. What would have happened had there been a hurricane here?
Oh, that's right. I still like the pictures of the person standing out there in the rain gear and says, it's raining out here.
Yeah.
We do that here, but nobody sees us.
Yeah.
Well, so all that's coming up on this edition of Queer Voices. But first, we go to News Wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Don Lupo.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 18th, 2007. Lesbi Gay Ugandans made history this week at a Kampala hotel by calling a first-ever news conference to demand their civil rights. Fearing the repressive regime of outspokenly anti-queer President Yoweri Museveni, however, most of the seven representatives of LGBT groups wore masks to hide their identity. They complained that police regularly arrest and beat gays or take bribes for not doing so. Lesbians and gay men are also frequent victims of violence by homophobic mobs in Uganda, especially in rural areas where most of the African country's population live. Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, have criticized the Ugandan government for allowing the abuses to continue. Dr. Paul Semagoma, one of the speakers at the news conference, said that medical schools in his country offer no information on sexuality. He told reporters that when an HIV-positive gay man came to his office, he didn't know how to advise him about safe sex. Even with all my training, he said, that was when I realized that if we were going to stop the HIV/AIDS epidemic, we needed to educate ourselves about sexual health for gays and lesbians, too. Uganda still maintains its British colonial-era law against male homosexual activity, which is punishable by up to life in prison. The group at their news conference called for repeal of that law, tighter controls on police, and the distribution of HIV/AIDS prevention material for gay men. Victor Juliet Mukasa of Sexual Minorities Uganda, probably the most high-profile activist in the country, whose home has been raided by police, told the news conference that, "Our message is simple and clear. Let us live in peace. We are human beings and should have the same rights as any other citizen of Uganda." But a government cabinet member said that the current administration has no intention of repealing the sodomy law and claimed that homosexuality is not a human rights issue.
The government of the Netherlands would beg to differ. It's launched a review of how LGBT people are treated in 36 countries that benefit from its routine financial aid. Same-gender sex is banned in 18 of those nations and punishable with fines, flogging, or in three cases, the death penalty. Dutch Development Cooperation Minister Bert Kenders has instructed embassy officials to conduct the research and report back in a few months' time, hoping it will stimulate discussion between his government and officials of the targeted nations, though none were named. Embassy officials have also been told to lobby for decriminalization of same-gender sex in countries that ban it. The Netherlands became the first country in the world to open civil marriage to same-gender couples in April 2001.
Thousands of gays and lesbians and their supporters demonstrated in a National Day of Equality on August 12th in Australia's largest cities, denouncing the government of Prime Minister John Howard and demanding the right to marry. The events marked the third anniversary of the passage of federal legislation limiting marriage to heterosexual couples. Demonstrators marched through the central business district of Melbourne, flying pink balloons displaying equal love symbols. Your friend or your neighbor or someone you don't even know might be a first-class taxpayer, organizer Ali Mohammed told reporters, but they're a second-class citizen in the eyes of the law. Activists marched in Sydney from Oxford Street, the hub of the queer community there, to City Hall. Speaking at the rally, Green Party Senator Kerry Nettle condemned the Howard-engineered marriage ban and said, 3 years later, we hear the Prime Minister talking about trying to impose a ban on same-sex adoptions from overseas just before another federal election. Under the proposed legislation, any child adopted legally overseas by a same-gender couple would not be granted a visa to enter Australia. Other National Day of Equality demonstrations were held in Brisbane and Perth. The country's Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission launched an investigation last year into inequities faced by same-gender couples. It urged passage of legislation to guarantee rights for them in its report to the government 2 months ago. But Prime Minister Howard has ignored their recommendations, claiming that there's no popular support for such laws. Recent polls contradict him.
The Church of Sweden entered its first ever contingent in Stockholm's LGBT Pride Parade on August 4th. The 30 marchers, including two senior priests, carried signs saying, "Love is stronger than everything." A church spokesman said officials want to break the big silence of the masses on LGBT matters. About 76% of Swedes belong to the Lutheran Church, although only 2% regularly attend services. Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt toured Pride Park on August the 2nd, the hub of the week-long festivities, becoming the first sitting Swedish head of state to visit a Pride venue. RuPaul and Bananarama performed on the park's main stage on August the 3rd, and about 50,000 people marched in the parade the next day, including several MPs and government ministers, with an estimated 500,000 spectators. Sweden has had a comprehensive registered partnership law for same-gender couples since 1995. It's expected to become the seventh country to fully legalize same-gender marriage sometime next year, including the right to marry in the church.
A National Assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, meeting this week in Chicago, urged its bishops not to defrock gay and lesbian ministers who violate a celibacy rule, but are in a mutual, chaste, and faithful committed same-gender relationship. Bradley Schmeling, a pastor at Atlanta's St. John's Lutheran Church, was the focal point of the debate. He'd been removed from the St. John's clergy list earlier this year after he told his bishop he was in a committed relationship with a man. Under church rules, an ECLA disciplinary committee said it had no choice but to defrock Schmeling. He continues to pastor at St. John's at the request of the congregation, though his name still won't appear on the clergy list. He called the church's relaxation of its rules a crack in the dam. Like other mainline Protestant denominations, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America has struggled for decades over how to treat its lesbi-gay parishioners and clergy. An eight-year study on human sexuality by an ELCA task force could recommend changes to church policy when its final report is issued in 2009. The Assembly voted to refer proposals on ordaining gays and lesbians and blessing same-gender couples to the task force so it could also consider those issues in its report. The 538-431 vote to ease the outright ban on partnered lesbi-gay clergy came on the final day of the week-long Assembly meeting following hours of emotional debate. Dozens of gay and lesbian ministers came out at the gathering, distributing a prayer booklet featuring first-person essays on the pain of being forced to choose between the ministry and a lifelong partner.
Meanwhile, a Texas church has refused to conduct a man's funeral after learning that he was gay. The funeral of Cecil Sinclair, a Navy veteran who served in Iraq in Desert Storm, was to have been held this week at the High Point Church in Arlington. Sinclair's brother Lee is a member of the church, and its pastor is the Reverend Gary Simons, brother-in-law of nationally known preacher Joel Osteen, a televangelist who's railed against abortion and homosexuality. Sinclair was diagnosed with a heart condition 6 years ago and died at age 46 from an infection following surgery intended to sustain him for a heart transplant. Church officials planned a meal and a slideshow for about 100 guests to commemorate Sinclair's life. Reverend Simons told the Dallas Morning News that some of the photos his family provided, however, had very strong homosexual images of kissing and hugging. My ministry associates were taken aback, he said. Shocking the already grieving family, the non-denominational church decided at the last minute not to hold the funeral for Sinclair. Can you hold the event and condone the sin and compromise our principles? Simons asked. We can't. A statement issued by Jeff Lutz, the executive director of Soul Force, an ecumenical group whose aim is to end what it calls spiritual violence in religious life, said this incident should inspire some much-needed national reflection about the dangers of religion-based bigotry. We should stop giving churches a pass when they preach God's unconditional love, and then ask gay and lesbian members to suppress an integral part of themselves in order to be worthy of that love.
And finally, Malaysia's first openly gay Christian pastor conducted a controversial worship service at a Kuala Lumpur hotel on August 12th, prompting anxiety from the country's Christian leadership in the predominantly Muslim nation, which also has large Buddhist and Hindu minorities. 37-year-old Reverend Uyang Wen Fang is an ethnic Chinese Malaysian who was ordained a minister in the United States in May. For some of us, especially our gay brothers and sisters, he said, we have experienced firsthand that Christianity has been used to persecute minorities. He urged his congregation of nearly 80 people, mainly gay men and lesbians, to reclaim our faith and celebrate our sexuality. But Reverend Wong Kim Kong, Secretary General of Malaysia's National Evangelical Christian Fellowship, worried that Christians do not want others to assume they condone such a thing. The Southeast Asian country outlaws sodomy, which is punishable by up to 20 years in prison and whipping. Worshippers at the service, including people from neighboring Singapore, hugged each other and sang hymns with lyrics like, "With justice as our aim, a queer and righteous people united in Christ's name." Reverend Uyang, who's worked at the queer-affirming Metropolitan Community Church in New York City, told his congregation that, "Today we're making history. We're here to tell Malaysians that we're all children of God."
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 18th, 2007, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Don Lupo.
And I'm John Beaupre.
The campaign trail to the White House is longer than ever before, long enough for a history-making stop in queer country. We'll spend some quality time with a couple of the Democratic travelers. But first, you may be surprised to learn about how one of their Republican predecessors made a contribution to LGBT rights.
Backing gay equality, former President Gerald R. Ford. Coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. While historians and news commentators have credited Ford with uniting the U.S. in the wake of the Watergate scandal, few have mentioned his statements on equality for gays. In an October 2001 interview with lesbian columnist Deb Price of the Detroit News, Ford called on fellow Republicans to join him in supporting equal treatment for gay people. The Republican Unity Coalition, which advocates making homosexuality a non-issue for the party, invited Ford to join their board of directors. He accepted, becoming the first U.S. president to join the board of a gay rights advocacy organization. When asked by Price if gay couples should receive full marriage equality, Ford said, quote, "I don't see why they shouldn't. I think that's a proper goal. I think they ought to be treated equally. Period." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, John DeBoer.
This is Queer Voices.
Linsky, with us in the studio is Jackie Weir, who is volunteer coordinator with the Thomas Street Community Health Services. Good evening.
Good evening.
And welcome to KPFT.
Thank you for inviting us.
Well, tell me a little bit about Thomas Street. How did it get started? What do you all do up there?
Well, what we do is treat people with HIV/AIDS. Exclusively, we're a one-stop shopping for HIV. If you're diagnosed in Houston with HIV, I would say that your choice should be Thomas Street Health Center. There are other agencies that treat people with HIV, but for people that are living with this disease, This is the place where we offer every service that you need.
And is it run by the city or the county?
It's run by the county.
Okay.
It's Harris County Hospital District's Center for HIV/AIDS.
Now, when it was first opened up, how many years ago was that?
1989.
I know there was some criticism that it was a little bit out of the way. And have those issues been addressed?
It was out of the way in those days, and it was also needed to be remodeled. It's been remodeled. It's on the historical register. It's actually a very beautiful building. It has everything that you need: primary health care, women's services, gynecological services, radiology, eligibility. Everything that you need is there to keep yourself healthy if you're living with HIV.
And what about accessibility?
The accessibility, I think, is better because the bus now comes down the street and stops in front of Thomas Street. In the past, it did not. You had to walk from Main Street. And we also have, you know, Metrolift comes there. Houston transportation. So it is accessible. It's two blocks off Main Street.
Okay, and there's a major bus that runs up and down.
And there is a major bus, Metro bus, that comes right in front of Thomas Street and lets people off in front of the
And there's also a big parking lot there.
There's a big parking lot there.
Free.
Free,
yes. Yes, as compared to the medical center.
Yes, which it's free.
So you said all types of services. Is this medical? Is there also counseling?
There's counseling. There's drug counseling. There's support groups. There's physical therapy, pharmacy, chemotherapy, translation services, social services, blood transfusion, HIV testing and counseling, child care services for those who have children in the family. When they're there taking care of their health care needs, there's someone there. AIDS Foundation Houston has funds for that program, the child care program there, and it is open Monday through Thursday from 8 until 4 o'clock. So if you have children and you need someone to watch your child while you're getting your health care, then you just apply to AIDS Foundation Houston and you get to avail yourself of those services.
Is there also a pharmacy there?
There is a pharmacy there.
So, and what qualification does a person have to be treated at Thomas Street?
Well, they first need to go through the eligibility department, which is located at Thomas Street. They have to have proof of income, proof of HIV, that they're HIV positive, and proof of their income.
Okay. So is anybody excluded?
No one is excluded. People with insurance, people on Medicare, Medicaid, no one is excluded. A lot of people do think that the only people that can come there are people who have a lack of funding, which that's not really true. We have people who come there that have private insurance, and they choose to come there simply because of the one-stop shopping, if you would call it that. That they don't have to be sent to somewhere else for rheumatology or radiology, or if we have a hepatitis C clinic, because as you know, a lot of people are dual diagnosed nowadays with Hep C
right,
and HIV.
Right. And how has this changed over the years? Not only in the people that come there, but I'm sure all these services weren't open up in the beginning.
They were not. I went there personally with my son in 1993, and we did not have a lot of those services there.
And it also changed in the fact that people are living longer.
They are living longer. They're living longer. And while they're living longer, instead of needing less services, they're needing more services. Because a lot of people, the people who do lose their lives because of HIV plus.
And what does that mean?
Well, that means they have other issues in their lives. Maybe they have addiction problems, alcoholism. And so combined with HIV, then you create a lot of problems for yourself. So that's why we've met the need. We have a substance abuse counselor. We have patient education. And education is the key to living with this disease.
Education is the key to living,
period.
Right.
But it is truly the key to living with this disease.
And now you mentioned your son. Your son had HIV?
My son had HIV. He was one of the first patients at Thomas Street in 1989. He did live 16 years, even though there was no meds in those days. There was very few meds. And he did manage to live quite a long time, even with just AZT.
So you dealt with your son, and then you decided to get involved?
Well, let me tell you what happened. I went to Thomas Street in 1993 with him, and I walked into that building, and it was being remodeled in those days, and I was totally horrified. I was like, oh, my goodness. So I went up to the front steps, and I was boo-hooing and crying, and the volunteer coordinator, who was with the People with AIDS Coalition at the time, came out and said, you know, why don't you volunteer? And I said, oh, no, I can't do that. You know, I was working. I had just come from San Francisco working in the oil business. So I said, I can't do that. And I said, I really do need to learn about HIV. And she said, well, this is the place for you to come to. So I finally talked myself into going. And I would go a half a day and then a whole day. And then pretty soon I was there a lot. And then I was offered a position with the People with AIDS Coalition. And my son did pass away in 1998. And I left the People with AIDS Coalition and was hired by the hospital district. I went to Bentall for 4 years. I always knew, though, that I would go back to Thomas Street. I knew that was where my heart was.
Yeah.
And then I had a request from him that was a specific request when he was really sick and in his last days. And he said, Mom, please don't forget the people at Thomas Street. And so I made that promise. So here I am.
So, talking about volunteering, what does a person who volunteers, what could they do? What are the requirements? How much time do you expect from a person who volunteers?
Well, as you may or may not know, the Harris County Hospital District has specific qualifications for volunteering, and we have just a myriad of things that people can do. As far as we have 12 community health centers and 3 hospitals, and there is a lot. We have a new concierge program desk that welcome people into the hospitals. We are recruiting people for those positions at LBJ and Bentall Hospital. So if anyone is interested in that, in those positions, they can call 713-873-2203 or go online to hchdonline.com, and there's more information about our program.
And that stands for
Harris County Hospital District. Yes.
Okay. Is that .com or .org?
hchdonline.com.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But my specific interest at Thomas Street is the patient mentor program, which has been carved out of the volunteer program as a specific program to address new patients who come for their very first visit to Thomas Street, because I remember my very first visit.
Sure, sure.
And most people do, I think.
And Ed Barnes is here also.
Yes, he is.
He didn't want to say anything, but we know better.
Well, I think that he can attest to his first day, and he was offered a patient mentor. And the patient mentor program was actually established in 2002 by a small grant from one of the pharmaceutical companies. And the mentor, they've called it a buddy program.
Yes, yes.
Okay?
Yes.
So when I went back there, I went back out there after 3 years at Bentall. I decided that I wanted to attach a little more importance to that, and I wanted to call it a mentor. And so that's what we call it, is a patient mentor. And that mentor is offered to a new patient that comes in to accompany them through that whole appointment.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
From eligibility to showing them where the restroom is, where the water fountain is. This is how you go to the pharmacy. This is how you go everywhere that they need to go, to the lab, any test they need. And so the patient mentor goes with them through the whole day.
That's fabulous.
Yes. And it takes some of that fear and that, because most people will tell you, you know, being diagnosed is bad enough, but coming for your first appointment is the scariest thing. And then to be a patient mentor, we require that you be a patient at Thomas Street for at least 1 year, and that you are willing to talk about your status. We can't have you being in secret, because you're not going to really help anyone. And that you You know, one of the most important things about that is that if you're positive, you can look somebody in the eye and you can say, I know what you're going through, and really mean that, because you do know what they're going through. And Ed, I think, can attest to that, because he had a mentor on the first day.
That's true. I went and asked Jackie if I could become a patient mentor, because I would sit, especially when I had to have chemotherapy because I had KS with my HIV, and in the oncology department at Thomas Street, you know, it was wonderful because I didn't have to go anywhere but Thomas Street for my chemotherapy treatments. But I would see kids who were absolutely frightened out of their minds, especially if they were going to go through chemo for the first time. And I would talk to them. And it goes back to my past, because I was a lay Episcopal chaplain on the first AIDS ward in the country at San Francisco General. So I just think this patient mentor program is wonderful, because I can sit with someone who's brand new and help alleviate the fear that they must be feeling, because I've been there. So that's pretty much it. And we lead them through everything. Eligibility, through the bureaucratic stuff of getting them registered in the computer system. Then we take them to the labs, the blood lab, sputum test, urinalysis, x-ray. Then we take them for patient screening. We take them to the nurse educators. If they're young, I'll refer them to a young counselor who handles the young kids. And that's kind of what shocked me a lot at Thomas Street, too, is the number of high school youth that are infected with HIV in Harris County, and also the number of women that are coming in. It's not a gay disease. Never really was.
It never was.
And what I see happening in the heterosexual community is somehow, through the politics in the past, they've been taught that this is a gay disease. It isn't. And as General Everett Koop under Reagan said, this disease does not discriminate. And unfortunately, I think many heterosexuals think they are not vulnerable to this disease, and they are. And it's escalating in Harris County.
Yes.
We're talking to Jackie Ware, who's volunteer coordinator for Thomas Street Clinic, and Ed Barnes, who's one of the mentors at this program. You know, we always think about the public hospital as having all this bureaucratic elements to it, from the billing to the impartiality. And so you're really telling me that you basically have somebody just follow a person through the entire process.
That's exactly what we do. We've only had, in the 3 years that we've been, this program has been resurrected, we've only had two people turn down a mentor. They're offered a mentor. They don't have to have a mentor, but most people are very thankful for that, because you're in a strange place, and besides, you've just having been diagnosed, and it's very scary. We just last week were able to sign up a adolescent for the adolescent mentor. We'd like to have an adolescent, because we have young folks that are coming there now. We also would like to we're looking for a transgendered. We want to address who our clients are, and that's who our clients are. Mostly women now, a lot of women. When I first went to Thomas Street, I knew every name of every woman there, and I don't know that now. And the fastest growing group are black and Hispanic women, heterosexual women.
So the message is not getting out there to the community about safer sex.
I think the message is getting to some parts of the community, but I still think we're failing in how we're delivering that message. I think we think we're doing it right, but I'm not sure that we are. And we have ongoing education of all description at Thomas Street, but you can go right down to outside to the patio area and hear some really misconceptions that just will drive you nuts. You just want to go, oh my goodness. You know, they still a lot of questions about safe sex. You know, well, if I'm positive and she's positive, well, why do I have to use a condom? and those kinds of, those kinds of issues. And so it's still a misconception. There's still a lot of secrets in out in the community. There's people who come there that I know that their families don't know.
Wow.
Particularly women that are mature women, it's mm-hmm. very hard to tell your child that you have HIV. One of the reasons is because I think we don't want to talk about, we don't want to think of our parents as being sexual.
Right.
It's hard to think about that.
Sure.
And so it's hard for a parent to go to a child and say, I'm HIV. So, but what I always tell people is, we've all done what it takes to get HIV. Just some were more blessed than others.
I know Ed has talked about how great the services are up there. And you know, the sort of mental image of a public hospital, that it isn't.
It isn't. My son had his, he had a great job in insurance, and he lost those things in the early, you know, early 80s. He was diagnosed. And I had never experienced the county facility. I'd never experienced that. So when I went there, I had this image of, oh, my goodness, you know, how is this going to be? What is this going to be like? And I was, I'm ever grateful to the Harris County Hospital District for his life, because I feel like that they get, they afforded him the opportunity to live as long as he did.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Ed?
You know, I have to say that, you know, I had private insurance and then I lost it, and then I couldn't get insurance because I was diabetic. And then the HIV, of course, they shoot you down completely. And I was terrified. Went to Thomas Street, and I have to say, the staff, the medical staff, you know, my brother was a doctor. He died in 83 of lymphocytic T-cell leukemia, the same T-cells that are attacked by the AIDS virus. And my brother used to work at Charity Hospital in New Orleans and just see the poor and so forth. And I loved him so much because he wanted to be like a missionary doctor. And but when you stop and think, some of these people in medicine, that's our whole practice is HIV and AIDS. And back in the 80s, it was just a death sentence. And to think you'd be practicing medicine with everyone dying. But yet at Thomas Street, I went in there, and in particular, there's a woman there who's a nurse educator who just was an angel to me, who just literally embraced me with love and compassion. And also the doctor that heads the treatment room there, I was so impressed. I mean, when I was diagnosed with KIS, I burst into tears, and he just got up from his desk, put his arms around me and said, don't you worry, we're going to get you through this. And they did. That's the kind of people that I've experienced at Thomas Street. Not only, it's not like a factory, it's just, they're just compassion. And for instance, when my chemotherapy was stopped, and they said, it appears the KS is gone, I walked out and the doctor told me, you won't need any more chemo for now. The two nurses that work out at the desk cheered and clapped and embraced me. And I never forgot those things. Everybody at Thomas Street. And my first day I talked to Jackie, and I was terrified. And she told me the story about her son and everything. And she just kind of, like a lot of us have lost our mothers, but she's there for all of us. And all the I went to a symposium on AIDS last week, and I was so impressed. Almost every patient mentor from Thomas Street was represented at that symposium. These are kids who want to learn more. They're all going to start in the LEAP program.
And what is the LEAP program?
Jackie.
The LEAP program is funded by Ron White Funding, and the Center for AIDS facilitates that program, and it stands for Learning, Empowerment, Participation, and Advocacy. Okay.
And it's a...
That's what it is. It's right. To teach clients and people that are interested, people that are affected and infected, everything about HIV, from funding to how to be an advocate, how to speak, if you want to open an agency.
It's sort of like a college course.
It is a college. It's 17 weeks, And I took it when it in 2000 when it started, but I'm taking it again this year because, you know, things change.
Yes.
So information changes. And I often say about the patient mentors, I want to see them become advocates out of Thomas Street. Not just in Thomas Street.
Right.
We've had two people that have gone to Washington for different endeavors as far as funding, and I would like to see all of the mentors. I think it's like raising children. When you raise your children and they don't need you any longer, then you've done a good job. So I'd like to see the mentors. I'd like to just be their wind beneath their wings to get them up and out, and also. It's helped them to not be in secret in their neighborhoods. I have a patient mentor right now. She rides the city bus, and she gets on the bus wearing her badge, and she says, I'm on my way to Thomas Street for my patient mentor volunteer position, and it's an HIV/AIDS clinic, and I have HIV/AIDS. Any questions?
Wow.
Okay. So she's come a long way. And we often laugh at her for doing that, but that to me is it's the ultimate.
Right.
That she's brave enough. She's a black young woman, and a lot of times in the black community, we still in the black and Hispanic community, we still have that stigma that we want that we're ashamed. And I just hope I live long enough to see us not be ashamed. I mean, we're not ashamed to say we have cancer or heart problems, but we're ashamed because we have HIV.
Right. And how do we change?
25 yeah. years later, we're still ashamed.
Right. Well, fabulous. So, to just volunteer in Harris County Hospital District, what do you do?
If you'd like to volunteer in Harris County Hospital District, you may call 713-873-2203 and talk. That's the primary volunteer office at Bentob, and talk to them about an orientation. You will go through and you will attend an orientation, an information session, an orientation. We will conduct a background check. We'll provide you with a TB skin test, a security badge, and then we will help you with an assignment. We'd like for you to be able to choose.
But to become one of the mentors in a HIV program, you actually have to be a patient.
Yes, you do. You have to be a patient or an affected member of the family.
Okay.
We do have one patient mentor who her husband is a patient, and she's been coming with him, however, to the clinic for over a year, so she knows the services. We want to be sure that the people know the services. And so there's no better way than having availed yourself of those services to know those services. So that's, and we want the new client to be assured that that patient mentor knows exactly what's going to go on and what the next step is and the next step is.
Okay. Jackie Ware is volunteer coordinator for Thomas Street Community Health Services, and that's on Thomas Street, no
less.
Yes, it
is.
And about where?
2015 Thomas Street, and it's off of North Main between 45 North and downtown.
Okay, so mm-hmm. It's really not that far from downtown.
It's really easy to get to.
And Ed, thank you for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
don't you want me? You know I can't believe it when I hear that you won't see me.
Don't you want me?
You know I don't believe you when you say that you don't need me.
Much too late to find. Did you change your mind? You better change it back or we will both be sorry. Don't you want me, baby? Don't you want me? Precious kisses, words that burn me. Lovers never ask you why. Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry? Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry? Broken down to the lowest turn. Been on the bottom line. Sure ain't no fun. But if we should be evicted from our home, we'll just move somewhere else. Still carry.
Four Puffs and a Piana. That was Extreme 80s from Screamin' Party Anthems. This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer and A.
And Jack Felice.
And we have in our studios the quintessential friend of this program, the founder of this program, the one that started it all, Ray Hill.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's a glad to be have access to your audience yet again.
Did you wear your flak jacket?
No, I don't get much flak. You know, that's one thing that happens when you get old. People say, oh, just make excuses for you.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. I never thought that would be the case, but people just kind of, I was just telling Jack that a friend of mine that I grew up, Jimmy Landry and I grew up in the 50s as gay teenagers on the streets of Houston.
What was that like?
I insist that he's older than me, but that's all right. He insists that I'm older than he is. And that was amazing. It was an era when if gay people were attacked, you didn't take them to the emergency room because the police in the emergency room would arrest them for being gay instead of the doctors treating them. And so I had a bar at one point called the Lounge Royal in what was the precursor of Montrose being the gay community. The term gay community meant the part of town where the bars were.
Right.
And the Lounge Royal was over on Alameda Street. It extended from the Pine Lounge at Alameda and Holman to Ken Ray's Red Devil.
Oh, my God.
And the Lounge Royal was just about in the middle, right across the street from the Black Bar, which was China Gates. And so we had, my bar was integrated because I just didn't believe in segregation stuff. And so I had an interesting crowd, not the really, you can't say the P word, so the really nose in the air. White Queen?
Yes.
Didn't come to my place. But I had the best pool players and some of the best looking men in town. And we kept a stack of sterile linens in the closet in the pool room so that if somebody needed medical attention because of an assault, we could spread sheets over the pool table. And Dr. Sam, who was an emergency pathologist, would come over, and there's always been plenty of male and female nurses in the community.
Right.
And they would patch somebody up from the violence. That's God. What it was like in the 50s.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
Well, see, people just don't understand how far we've come as a people. And shortly after that, in the early 60s, I'd gone to Tulane University and was teaching English composition rhetoric at Newcomb College. And I came home to work on my master's degree, and my master's degree was on what was not a politically incorrect term, black sissies, transgendered black people.
Right.
And I lived...
I've heard that term,
I lived in an apartment over the Red Lily Q, which was a straight pool hall on Dowling Street.
Okay.
With five black transgendered people. We called them drag queens or black sissies.
Right, that was usually the term back then.
The whole thesis of my master's thesis was that black sissies and white sissies are the same sissies.
Well, it wasn't until the 80s that we... Virginia Prince coined the term transgender.
But I was interested in the phenomena, and I was offended that the professional sciences, I mean the people who wrote articles in Psychology Today and psychiatric journals, differentiated between people whom we would now call transgender that were black from people who we now call transgender that were white. But they did that. Professional.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the whole thing was gender dysphoria, and I don't think anybody's used that term in any academic sense in 40 years.
I think when they diagnosed me, they used it. I saw that written on there.
Yeah, well, it's a clinical term that has virtually no meaning. But the reason I thought Jack gave me an invitation is that there might be some time I want to come in. I want to talk about some of the things that have not really changed.
Yeah, there's a number of things that are very obvious and visible today in Houston that maybe some of the people out there really don't see.
One of the things is the young man who just got out of prison who went to EJ's.
Right.
And picked up an airline attendant and went home with the attendant to Paraland and killed him. And then carried his body to the assailant's grandfather's farm outside of San Antonio and buried him in the shallow grave. It took about 3 days to figure that out and solve it.
Mm-hmm.
It was not solved by the Paraland Police Department. It was not even investigated or reported by the Houston Police Department. It was solved by a private investigator, a person who makes a living finding missing persons. And I met him recently at a gathering to commemorate victims of violence.
Hate crimes, I was there with you.
Yeah, and it was very interesting talking to that man who has a company that finds missing persons, and he knows how to do that. And I was interested in listening to him tell me that the Paraland Police Department, every time he would talk about investigating the case, said, you know, the victim, and this is gay. As if that would somehow make a difference in a homicide.
Well, in Paraland, that would be.
Well, we think about Paraland being that way, but let me tell you, when I talked to John Silva is a lieutenant in the police department, captain now, I think he's captain. John Silva, I've known John Silva for many years. I've got respect professionally for John Silva. And I talked to him about are you going to report this as a hate crime on Houston statistics? He said, no, why? It's for Pearland to report. I said, do you really think Pearland reports hate crime statistics?
What did he say?
He said, but it's their case. And I said, well, if you think like a cop, that may be true, but I don't think like a cop. I think like a gay person. And I do not have any confidence that Pearland is going to report that into the National Statistics Bank.
Oh, no.
As a hate crime. And the contact these two people met in a Houston bar. And we have a mechanism for reporting it as a hate crime. So I think it should be reported as a hate crime that, at least in part, initially came from Houston. That way, at least it'll get in statistics. And to me, there are no excuses for hate crimes not getting reported.
Absolutely not.
Now, that's John Silva. That's somebody that I've known and I've respected. I worked with when he was the chief advisor to the police chief. I followed his career into other things. John is an intelligent, caring person. He deals with me a little caution because he's actually been in the police chief's office when I have barked at other police officers and basically emasculated them because I understood what their job was better than they did. But I don't think I should have to train John Silva into the importance of hate crime statistics nationally, and certainly not those that were initiated in Houston became crimes elsewhere.
Well, because a lot of times one of the arguments against any kind of legislation for hate crimes is, well, there aren't any.
There aren't any.
Right? Oh, there aren't any. Oh, there are only a few scattered here and there. And the reason is because usually the police departments of the various cities just don't report them.
Well, and you take other incidents. Of course, you take the transgendered sergeant.
Yes. Julia.
Mm-hmm. Oliver. You take Sergeant Oliver. I've known Sergeant Oliver for many years. And I was showed up at the press conference where we met in the law's office to make
right.
the announcement. And I said, Sergeant Oliver, I had no idea. My gaydar didn't go off. And she said, I'm not gay. I'm transgender. Talking about a swift kick in
you
the place where
yeah,
it is.
You got to work on your T-dar.
Right, right. Yeah, I got to work on my T-dar. But Sergeant Oliver came out with much fanfare. News conferences and the whole nine yards, and has maintained rank and maintained somewhere within the established that we would call police.
Absolutely.
And has gone unharmed. Meanwhile, I know a lieutenant whose name I'm not at liberty to use, and he was pushed out of HPD and into the marshal's office, which is definitely a kick downstairs.
Right.
Simply because he let it be known that he was gay. Now, I know other openly gay police officers, Russ Altsbrook and a bunch of others, who were a little more forthcoming and open than the lieutenant I talk about, who are at least static. I wonder if they get the opportunities for advancement that officers who are not openly gay would get. And so that remains to be seen. But I'm keeping an eye on it because it's Ray Hill's job is to watch the cops.
Right. Right?
Just before Pride Week, when Sergeant, Steve Jett was captain of the vice squad.
Right.
A bunch of his goons ran into an arcade out on I-10 at Kirkwood. I mean, way the hell in going out there beyond the outer belt.
That's a long right. way out there.
Well, they ran into the arcade and they gathered up five people, one of which was arrested, the black sergeant that tried to get him to expose himself, invited him into the booth and said, show it to me, and he said no, and he left, was arrested anyway. They carried him outside and they lined him up under my security camera where I keep an eye on him, and they said, all right, now that it's Pride Week, I guess you're really proud of this. Nobody knew what the hell they were talking about. Not one person that they arrested was gay aware enough to know that it was Pride Week.
Oh, my God.
They went out there and arrested a bunch of heterosexually married, straight guys who had gone to get away from the heat and watch a few flicks in an arcade, and they had went out and done various things to seduce them into getting arrested, and arrested them whether they responded, seduced or not, carried them outside and said, where's your gay pride now? Duh. They didn't have a hint. And then, would you believe the day before Houston Gay and Lesbian and Transgendered Political Caucus had its endorsement meeting, a gang of vice goons broke into or run into a business of the largest investors in new gay community business development.
Right.
Arrested three people, only one of which had anything to do with that business. Two people, one of them manages a restaurant, the other manages a convenience store. And packed them off into jail, charged them with selling and promoting sexual devices. There are 112 outlets for sexual devices inside the city limits of Houston. I found out today that there had been 6 cases in the last 4 years. One of them was pled out as a Class C misdemeanor. The offense is a Class A misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
So you drop it down 2 levels and they pay a fine like a traffic ticket and
right.
No record. And the other 5 cases were either dismissed by the district attorney, the court, or they just simply didn't make it to trial and didn't have any conviction at all. So 5
out of 6. Is it just harassment then?
Well, if they hit the only gay.
Well, I'm talking about the fact if they arrest or bring in and there are no convictions.
Jennifer, there is nothing about latex, I don't care how you shape it, to make it contraband. There's no law that makes latex contraband. Now, they do have a silly law that came out of Georgia that says sell in promotion and wholesale sell in promotion, which is a felony.
Right.
And wholesale kicks in if you're found with 6 or more. But there's not been any cases except this one incident. And I got those folks out of jail at 1 o'clock on Wednesday morning. And at 7 o'clock Wednesday afternoon, half of city council was lined up for gay and lesbian transgendered political caucus endorsement. And you were there.
I was
there. You're the president.
I'm the president.
I walked in and gave that speech. You could have heard a mouse fart 2 blocks away.
Well, the thing is that shame on me, I did not know about that till you stood up there
well,
and said
something.
Well,
I did that on purpose.
Well, I know. And
I did that on purpose. Of course,
we had 10 either existing council members or future council members that were standing there who all support GLBT issues.
So the vice timing is way off.
Huh.
And I will have meetings later this week with city council members and assistant chiefs of police and captains. But we're having some police problems. The reason I want to come on Queer Voices tonight, my home number is 713-523-696. I'm not telling you anything. You can look it up. It's listed. Ray Hill. If you have had what you think is unreasonable police action that affected you, now, if you got busted with dope and you had dope, don't call me. But if you were affected with something that you think prejudice may have been a part of it, I need to talk to you. Call me.
Absolutely. Give you a number again.
713-523-6969. Or you can email me at ray@theprisonshow.org.
Tell us briefly about your prison show before we close.
Tune in Friday night at 9 o'clock and you'll hear all of it. You can stand.
This is Jennifer Ray. We've been talking with Ray Hill, and this is Queer Voices.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
When the Human Rights Campaign and the Logo Cable Channel joined to host the first ever nationally televised U.S. presidential forum on LGBT issues, six Democratic candidates answered the call. Before a live audience on August 9th, they tackled a wide range of issues, including HIV/AIDS and health care reform, national policy and legislative matters like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Defense of Marriage Act, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and hate crime protections, the complexities of religion and morality in politics, and the civil unions versus marriage debate. This Way Out aired excerpts from the remarks of New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson and former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel last time. One of the other Democratic presidential hopefuls has become well known in the queer community for saying that he's on a journey regarding marriage equality. Panelists Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post, lesbian rock icon Melissa Etheridge, and HRC Executive Director Joe Solmonis tried to map the journey of former North Carolina Senator and 2004 Vice Presidential candidate John Edwards with the able guidance of moderator Margaret Carlson of Bloomberg News.
Senator Edwards, welcome. We're so delighted that you're here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Melissa.
Yes, I know you understand the health care need of lower income people, but do you understand the special needs of people in gay and lesbian couples who cannot depend on their partner's insurance for protection because they are not a legal spouse or have to pay extra taxes on a benefit?
The answer to your question is those rights should be available to gay and lesbian couples. I actually was the first candidate to come out with a universal health care plan, which I'm very proud of, and I've made it very clear that those rights to gay and lesbian couples would be exactly the same as they would for straight couples. And so those health care benefits would be available to someone in that situation. And I might add, just a few weeks ago, I was at the L.A. Gay and Lesbian Center, which is an extraordinary place, which I'm sure some people here are familiar with here in the Los Angeles community, where they're doing amazing, amazing work. But there's a message from my visit there that I think is really important for America to hear, which is I met a whole group of young people who were there because they were homeless. And they were homeless because they came out of the closet and told their parents the truth. And their parents kicked them out of the home. But without that place, where would these young people go? And it just can't be that in America, people think that's okay. They can't believe that's okay. And they need to hear and see exactly what I saw when I was there, because it was moving, it was touching, and I actually believe that that kind of experience would have a huge impact on the American people if they could just see it.
Mm-hmm. Joe?
Senator, you've expressed your opposition to same-sex marriage, and you've raised your faith as part of the reason for your opposition. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what is it within your religion that's leading you to this position?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I shouldn't have said that, because, first of all, I believe to my core in equality. My campaign for the presidency is about equality across the board. And it makes perfect sense to me that gay and lesbian couples would say, civil unions, great. 1,100 federal benefits, great. You know, give us these rights. We deserve these rights. And they're absolutely right about that. But it stops short of real equality. It makes perfect sense to me that people would feel that way. I mean, I can understand it. It makes sense. And the only thing I would say about the faith question is, I think from my perspective, it is wrong. It's because we have seen a president in the last 6+ years who tries to impose his faith on the American people. And I think it is a mistake, and I will not impose my faith belief on the American people. I don't believe any president of the United States should do that. I believe in the separation of church and state.
I'm just wondering, then, if you could briefly talk about, as you said, it is not your faith, then what is at the core of that resistance? I know that you said you're on a journey, and I'm curious where and when you might end up on that journey.
I can tell you where I am. First of all, I think you deserve to know the truth. And the truth is that my position on same-sex marriage has not changed. I think political double, well, we're past the time of political doublespeak about this. I do believe strongly in civil unions and the substantive rights that go with that. I believe we desperately need to get rid of DOMA. I think we need to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I think we need to get rid of those things. And by the way, just as an aside, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is not just wrong now. It was wrong when it began. It's been wrong the entire time. As is true with DOMA, exactly the same thing's true with DOMA. All I can tell you is where I am today. That's the best I can do. You know, you deserve to know that from me. Today, I believe in all these other things, but I do not support same-sex marriage. And the last thing I want to say, we have such work to do to keep loving couples together who are separated because of immigration laws that are unfair. To have an employer be able to walk in to an employee and say, you are fired because of your sexual orientation. And nothing can be done about it. To have someone brutally murdered in the United States of America, in the United States of America, because of their sexual orientation, and not have that be a hate crime. We're better than this. The United States of America is better than this. And these things that we have talked about, all these substantive issues of equality, which is really what the discussion has been about, these are part of my heart, soul, and core. And they are not just issues that I will answer when I'm in front of you. They are things that I will fight for every day, both in the presidential campaign and as President of the United States. What I would say is this to every single person in this room and everyone who can hear the sound of my voice. It's great that you're having a presidential forum. I love that. I'm glad we're talking about these really important issues of equality. But I want to add to that, the real change and the real movements in America, they didn't start in the Oval Office. They started in places and in communities just like this, with people with courage and strength who went out and stood up and fought for what was right, who marched and spoke up. That's what you're doing today, and you're going to change this country along with the next president of the United States. Thank you all.
Edwards' call for grassroots activism received a strong response, but questions about his religious influences still persist. First-term Illinois Senator Barack Obama is a big crowd pleaser, but that didn't stop the forum panelists from holding his feet to the fire on marriage equality and other key issues.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you. First, I'm going to turn it over to Joe.
Senator, thank you so much for joining us. It's a real honor to have you here with us tonight, and thank you for being the first to accept our invitation. You have said in previous debates that it is up to individual religious denominations to decide whether or not to recognize same-sex marriage. And so my question is, what place does the church have in government-sanctioned civil marriages?
Well, it is my strong belief that the government has to treat all citizens equally. I come from that in part out of personal experience. When you're a black guy named Barack Obama, you know what it's like to be on the outside. And so my concern is continually to make sure that the rights that are conferred by the state are equal for all people. That's why I opposed DOMA in 2006 when I ran for the United States Senate. That's why I'm a strong supporter, not of a weak version of civil unions, but of a strong version in which the rights that are conferred at the federal level to persons of, you know, who are part of a same-sex union are compatible. Now, as a consequence, I don't think that the church should be making these determinations when it comes to legal rights conferred by the state. My view is that we should try to disentangle what has historically been the issue of the word marriage, which has religious connotations to some people, from the civil rights that are given to couples.
But on the grounds of civil marriage, can you see to our community where that comes across as sounding like separate but equal?
Well, look, you know, when my parents got married in 1960-61, it would have been illegal for them to be married in a number of states in the South. So obviously this is something that I understand intimately. It's something that I care about. But I would also say this, that if I were advising the civil rights movement back in 1961 about its approach to civil rights, I would have probably said it's less important that we focus on an anti-miscegenation law than we focus on a voting rights law and a non-discrimination employment law and all the legal rights that are conferred by the state. Now, it's not for me to suggest that you shouldn't be troubled by these issues. I understand that and I'm sympathetic to it. But my job as president is going to be to make sure that the legal rights that have consequences on a day-to-day basis for loving same-sex couples all across the country, that those rights are recognized and enforced by my White House and by my Justice Department. And look, you know, semantics may be important to some. From my perspective, what I'm interested in is making sure that those legal rights are available to people. And if we have a situation in which civil unions are fully enforced, are widely recognized, people have civil rights under the law, then my sense is that's enormous progress.
Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post has some questions for you.
Yes. You've gotten some praise for taking to the pulpits of black churches and telling the black community, talking to the black community about its responsibilities. Now, you and I both know that there's a homophobia problem in the black community.
Right.
So how are you going to talk to the black community about that, both as candidate and if you are elected to the White House as president?
I have already done so. I'm somebody who talks about LGBT issues, not just before HRC. I was with Harold Ford. He organized a forum of black ministers in Tennessee. And I specifically talked about the degree to which the notion of gay marriage in black churches has been used to divide, has been used to distract. I specifically pointed out that if there's any pastor here who can point out a marriage that has been broken up as a consequence of seeing two men or two women holding hands, then you should tell me, because I haven't seen any evidence of it.
And what I've also said
is if you think that issue is more important to the black family, which is under siege, if you think that's more important than the fact that black men don't have any jobs and are struggling in the inner cities, then I profoundly disagree with you.
Senator, real quickly, a recent poll from the New York Times and MTV of Americans ages 17 to 20 show that 44% of them favor same-sex marriage compared to 28% of the public. Now, you're running as a candidate of change, but how can you run as a candidate of change when your stance on same-sex marriage is decidedly old school?
Oh, come on now. I mean, look, guys, we can have this conversation for the duration of the 15 minutes, but there's a reason why I was here first. It's because I've got a track record of working on these issues. This has been the cause of my life, and will continue to be the cause of my life, making sure that everybody's treated fairly and that we've got an expansive view of America where everybody's invited in, and we are all working together to create the kind of America that we want for the next generation. All the candidates in this race are going to be terrific on these issues compared to certainly the candidates in the other party right now. And that's unfortunate, because this shouldn't be a partisan issue. The one thing I guess I would say about my candidacy and something you should think about is I don't just talk about these issues where it's convenient. There's a reason why in my announcement I talked about these issues. There's a reason why I talk about gays and lesbians and transgender people in my stump speeches. I'm somebody who I think is willing to talk about these issues even when it's hard in front of black ministers. I'm willing to talk about AIDS at Saddleback Church to evangelicals and talk about why we need to have condom distribution to deal with the scourge of AIDS. So that's the kind of political courage that I hope all of you recognize is going to be necessary in order for us to create the kind of America that we all want. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Obama is widely considered to be running second in the race for the Democratic Party's nomination for president, while most polls show Edwards in third place. Since scheduling conflicts kept Senators Joe Biden and Chris Dodd from participating in the forum, and HRC's invitation was not accepted by any of the Republican candidates, there are now two campaigners we've yet to hear from, Progressive Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and by most accounts, the frontrunner for the nomination, Senator Hillary Clinton. Next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Don Lupo, John Beaupre, Rex Wagner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, and Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with John DeBoer contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out anytime and exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also get there by clicking on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are supported by direct tax-deductible donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. We'll thank you with your choice of some very special programming CDs. You can also contact us at TWORadio@AOL.com or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KALW San Francisco, California, 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, WZKW Kingsville, Ohio, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
The day is not in my favor. I get dressed up, and I wear my cowboy hat. When looks in the mirror are turning back voices, it's
Brianna Lane from her album Radiator that was called Cowboy Hat. And coming up after this from the Pacifica Archives, Remembering Stonewall. This is Queer Voices.
This week on From the Vault, we listen to the voice of one of the most unique figures of the 20th century, Quentin Crisp. Mr. Crisp died in 1999 at the age of 90. The city of New York, his adopted home for the last 18 years of his life, held a memorial for him soon after his death. A remarkable collection of people came to give their remembrances, and Pacifica was there to record the event. Today we bring you that event, along with selections from Quentin's one-man performance and Evening with Quentin Crisp. In the 1920s, without the benefit of psychoanalysis, community centers, support groups, or self-help books, Quentin Crisp defied those who despised him for walking the streets of London looking, in his own words, undeniably like a homosexual person. His very existence, his survival, was his defiance. He was at the forefront of the struggle for gay and lesbian people simply to be. In short, he personified the line penned by Shakespeare, "To thine own self be true," and gave the ideals of civil disobedience and nonviolent protest new significance. The following program is a recording of the memorial service held in New York City, March 3, 2000, and explores the legacy of Mr. Crisp through the remembrances of his family and closest friends.
You can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York.
It was Quentin's lofty goal to meet everyone on earth before he died. In a sense, friends were a hindrance to this ambition. "I like my friends," he would say, "but I adore strangers."
He was outrageous and wild and all over the place, but he just had these exquisite manners.
Take a look around the room for a second at each other, and isn't it amazing that we have one variety of everything here? It is amazing, all because of one man, and I think that's beautiful.
There's a wild rumor going around London that the Queen Mother died 17 days ago, but they put her on ice until August for her 100th birthday. And I thought, isn't that just the sort of gossip that you would love to tell Quentin Crisp?
He was a great and gentle man with probably the most focused identity of our time. He gave so tirelessly to everyone he could and left quite a hole in our universe with his passing.
My name was, as you'll know if you read the book, my Christian name was Dennis in a time gone by.
My father, Louis, Quentin's elder brother, not elder brother, but 1 year older, I was his first child, and I could have been called Louise after my father, Louis, or Geraldine after his brother, Gerald. But I was named Denise after Dennis Quentin. Even one of my grand nephews is called Quentin. Quentin's family loved, respected, and admired him. And I'm really impressed to see so many people who felt the same about him. Well, I didn't get to see him very often because I lived in, and I still do, lived in South America, but we wrote to each other very often. And his letters were obviously very witty, full of wisdom. But something that perhaps not many know, they were very warm and caring. He used to sign them, Quentin, oh sorry, Uncle Dennis. When he still lived in England and working as an artist's model, for instance, he wrote, "They don't really need models. But I have become a sort of status symbol, a naked Cadillac." After a short visit to New York, he advised me, "Now that I am back, I am writing all about it for the English papers and advising everyone to leave for America at once." Finally, when his dream came true and he came to live in New York, and I was going through some difficult circumstances, times, his letter to me read, "If you possibly can, you should come here, though I am aware of your difficulties. Everyone is rich, and everyone is handsome, so you could marry almost anybody within a week." But it was the caring behind the one-liners that touched me. When my husband, whom he had, my first husband, whom he had never met, died suddenly in 1973, his caring and tenderness was one of the things that helped assuage my grief. Well, I'm about to become emotional, which I'm sure my very English Uncle Quentin would have abhorred, so I will leave it that way there, and we'll miss him.
I have now been to various places, including New York, which I'm able to tell you, if you don't know, is just like heaven.
Performance artist Penny Arcade.
I met Quentin almost immediately when he came to the East Village, but I didn't really get to know him until the late 80s when Jack Eric Williams would bring him to all my shows. And I was stunned by Quentin when I finally did get to know him, because when I would just see him in the street, I thought, oh, that queen, you know. Well, I mean, I was raised by gay men, so, you know, I'm very dishy and judgmental. And when I did get to know him, I was stunned by his non-elitism, by his egalitarian spirit, that he was truly that person. And in 1993, for the last performance of Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore, he and Marianne Faithfull were in the show. And in the middle of the show, I asked Quentin if he would promise to live to be 100. And he said, "Yes, I promise I shall live to be 100, Miss Arcade." Shortly before that, he had named me as his anima figure. He called me up and he said, "Would it be all right with you if I name you as my soulmate for the London Sunday Telegraph?" And I said, "Yes," and I was, of course, incredibly pleased and honored, because, you know, I did know that Quentin and I shared a lot of things in common. There were all these different things that I thought we had in common that would make me his soulmate or his anima figure. Then I got mailed the page from the magazine. It was a Sunday magazine for the London Sunday Telegraph. And the quote from Quentin was, "Most people would be horrified to be publicly identified by me as their soulmate. But Miss Arcade is impervious to embarrassment." Somewhere in this time, Quentin came under a lot of fire from gay activists. At the time, I had a very aggressive attitude about gay politics, because all my friends were dying, and by 1992, I had lost over 200 friends, and I often didn't understand Quentin's position on it. He would say, "Well, when I was young, syphilis was all the rage." And I did understand that, in fact, he was over 70, actually over 80 at that time. And I know that people stop changing when they're 25 or 30. So, I mean, to imagine somebody at his age, I would imagine that he had a position on things. And at that time, he said to me, because he would always say that gay people weren't real, and I had a problem with this, and he would say, "Well, if the opposite of gay is straight, then the opposite of straight is crooked. If the opposite of real is imaginary, I don't mind being an imaginary person, but I don't like being a crooked person. He called me up and he said, Miss Arcade, I know I've always promised you to live to be 100 years old, but I was wondering if you would give me a dispensation so that I only had to live to be 90. And I said, well, Quentin, okay, you can die at 90 if you want, but it's only 2 years from now. I said, you can't leave the planet until you debrief us on this horrible so-called postmodern era. And he said, well, what's postmodern? And I said, I don't know. I don't believe in it. And he said, I don't believe in it either. And I want to say that Quentin's great legacy is in his writing, and that everyone can have a personal relationship with Quentin through his writing. And I encourage you, if you haven't read him, to read him, because he was what we all want to be. He grew up to be himself. And that is the greatest thing that anyone can achieve.
I mean, modern science is so unkind that one might live to be 90.
Director of the Quentin Crisp Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, Louis Coilani.
I'm not bragging, but merely brimming with joy when I say that Quentin wrote of our friendship. I can think of no higher compliment than to be immortally linked with Quentin through his books. Two of my favorite heroes are Quentin Crisp and Shakespeare's King Henry V. An odd pairing, for Quentin was as gentle as Henry was warlike. Henry's cause was to conquer nations through force and violence. Quentin's cause was to educate his oppressors through the art of self-expression. Yet as different as they were, both of my heroes found themselves outnumbered and fought against the odds. In a famous speech from Shakespeare's play, King Henry rouses his army by invoking two early Christian martyrs. Their names were Crispin and Crispian. And they were brothers. I like to think that as a young man, Quentin, who was often beaten bloody in the city streets merely for being himself, borrowed his last name, Crisp, from these brothers, these two courageous men whose brains were dashed out on the streets of ancient Rome because of their beliefs. And Crispin, Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world. But we in it shall be remembered, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers. From this day to the ending of the world, Quentin lives on through us, and we few here tonight, we band of brothers and sisters, we carry on.
Everyone is fascinating who can be got to talk about himself. This is the thing. Nothing is boring except a lie. If you can get people really to tell you the truth about themselves, then they're all interesting. More than that, they're all fascinating. So that as far as I'm concerned, if I've hungered for success, it's because it will bring me to more people. As far as I'm concerned, that's all there is. To spread yourself out to the utmost limit before the largest number of people.
The following two speakers are Quentin's longtime friends, Mr. Evan Thompson and Mrs. Joan Thompson.
In the summer of 1982, our son, Owen Thompson, who regrets that he can't be here tonight, but he's in rehearsal, asked Mr. Crisp if he would play Lady Bracknell in a production of The Importance of Being Earnest. And when he stopped laughing, he very graciously said yes, which is how I came to have the honor of directing Mr. Crisp the first time he appeared on any stage as a character other than himself. Although, of course, it really was himself. And, of course, I didn't really direct him. I sort of said, well, you come over and sit there, and then you say it, and the others will move around you. And he did, magnificently, with the most incredible understanding of every nuance that Oscar Wilde had written, with the great wit, and with that underlying melancholy that was at the soul of all of Mr. Crisp's humor. And on one occasion, we were relaxing in the dressing room, and he said to me, "You know, I could never really be an actor because I have no idea why any human being behaves as he does. But I do know where to put the semicolons."
Oh, well, not to cry. In that same production, I got myself appointed. I played Miss Prism to his Lady Bracknell, but I somehow got myself appointed as his dresser. And we were fond of each other even that long ago. I never called him anything but Mr. Crisp the entire 18 and a half years that I knew him well. And he never called me anything but Mrs. Thompson, except in that production, because the dresser, the movie of The Dresser, was at the time very current, and we'd both seen it and loved it. He called me Norman. And, of course, I called him Sir. And that was the only first name that he ever called me. Anyway, just would like to end by saying to Mr. Crisp, "Hello, Mr. Crisp. This isn't Mrs. Norman Maine, but it is Norman, and good night."
Performance artist and impersonator Stephen Sorrentino.
I didn't realize how attached I was to Mr. Crisp. I got to live for a month with him. I got to survive for a month with him in Minneapolis when we filmed the movie Homo Heights. And I was a little embarrassed because in the movie I wore a dress, and Mr. Crisp and I always had a good relationship, and I was a regular Long Island kind of guy, and he was Mr. Crisp. And I put on the dress, and I said, "I'm a little embarrassed, what do you think?" And he looked close and said, "I think you look quite cozy." So we spent a month in heels together. It was incredible. I would just like to say from the bottom of my heart that when he was put in hospital for the first time, and I was a part of that, and I apologized till the last time we saw each other, for years, like Miss Arcade, I had to apologize. I brought to the hospital a beautiful robe with a big Q on it. And he said to me, "Why are you so kind to me?" And I thought, and I remember being a young man looking at the naked civil servant and saying, "I can be an individual, I could be myself, because if a man like that has that kind of courage, and if that courage exists in a human being, then I certainly could be myself, no matter what." And I said, "Mr. Crisp, without you, there would be no me." And he just smiled. So I think right now that there's a chair and a drink, a real drink, as he'd say, up in heaven, and he's looking down, and he would hate all this fuss. But I think he would stop for a second and say just one word: lovely.
Anxiety is in the future, and regret is in the past, and betrayal is in other people. But in you, there is only yourself, there is only your happiness.
Next we hear from dramatist Tim Fountain.
There was the obligatory lunch at Cafe 99, because I think the Cooper Diner was closed at the time. And he sat in the window, and he received his meal free as recompense for sitting in the window. And he held forth for another 2 hours. Later, as we tottered home through the snow, I told him that he was contractually obliged to approve the script I was writing. In typical Quentin style, he said, "I accept whatever you write." And he did. I spoke to him a couple of weeks before he died, and I asked him if he'd received the play, and he said, "I've received it, but I haven't read it." He was far more interested in telling me about his hernia, which he said proudly was as big as an orange. Quentin never got to see the play, but I think he received word of what a big success it was. Night after night, an incredible cross-section of people, from Kensington ladies to Camden queens, sat rapt by his words and stories and Beck's portrayal of him. I think they marvelled at the sheer courage with which he lived his life. As Beck said in a tribute to him at the Royal Albert Hall, never forget that Quentin Crisp was out in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s. He stayed out in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. And that's an incredible thing. When he passed away, some of the English press, and indeed some of the English gay press, tried to portray him as, to use Quentin's own phrase, a sad, lonely, embittered old queen. They were so wrong. I can't think of anyone who suffered as much and was less bitter or more generous with his time.
The only advantage of being an outsider to such an extent was that every day, just to live at all was a kind of triumph.
Quentin's former agent and editor of The Wit and Wisdom of Quentin Crisp, Guy Kettlehack.
Asked to suggest the remedy for a broken heart, Quentin replied, "The remedy is to learn not to value love because it is requited. If you have love to give, you give it, and you give it where it is needed. Once you have this idea in your head, the idea of a broken heart will disappear." Asked if he believed in God, well, in a conversation with someone he knew would not take offense, his answer was simply no. But in his response to the question at a performance he gave in New Orleans, he gave an answer which, when I have read it to various Jesuit, Buddhist, and Orthodox Jewish friends, has met with their instantaneous and awestruck agreement. It's the closest to a manifesto I've ever heard Quentin make. Here it is. Do you believe in God? Well, now, the last time you know who was mentioned, I began by saying I wouldn't like to say anything that gave offense. And someone in the audience said, "Why stop now?" But this is still something that worries me, so if at any moment anyone finds anything I say offensive, they have only to jump up and down, make a scene, and we will stop. I believe, like most people, not that of which logic can convince me, but what my nature inclines me to believe. This is so of nearly everybody. I am unable to believe in a God susceptible to prayer as petition. It does not seem to me to be sufficiently humble to imagine that whatever force keeps the planets turning in the heavens is going to stop what it's doing to give me a bicycle with 3 speeds. But if God is the universe that encloses the universe, or if God is the cell within the cell, or if God is the cause behind the cause, then this I accept absolutely. And if prayer is a way of aligning your body with the forces that flow through the universe, then prayer I accept. But there is a worrying aspect about the idea of God. Like witchcraft or the science of the zodiac or any of these other things, the burden is placed elsewhere. This is what I don't like. You see, to me, you are the heroes of this hour. I do not think the earth was ever meant to be your home. I do not see the sky as a canopy held over your head by cherubs, or see the ground as a carpet laid at your feet. You used to live an easy lying down life in the sea. But your curiosity and your courage prompted you to lift your head out of the sea and gasp this fierce element in which we live. They are seated on Mars with their little green arms folded, saying, "We can be reasonably certain there is no life on Earth, because there the atmosphere is oxygen, which is so harsh that it corrupts metal. But you learned to breathe it. Furthermore, you crawled out of the sea and you walked up and down the beach for centuries until your thigh bones were thick enough to walk on land. It was a mistake, but you did it. Once you have this view of your past, not that it was handed to you, but that you did it, then your view of the future will change. This terror you have of the atom bomb will pass. Something will arise which will breathe radiation if you learn to breathe oxygen. So you don't have to worry. Don't keep looking into the sky to see what is happening. Embrace the future. All you have to do about the future is what you did about the past. Rely on your curiosity and your courage and ride through the night.
When you have your style, you lay it at the feet of your neighbor. You don't get better than them. You don't put your style across other people. You offer it to them. It is not a question of getting the better of other people. It is not a question of being more peculiar than other people. When I was in Woking, a man said, "All you want us to do is wear funny clothes." "I want you to wear funny clothes if you're funny people."
American composer and writer Ned Rorem.
No one was remotely like Quentin, with his extreme politeness, his unbitchy wit, and his basic common sense in the form of aphorism. With his death, the world weighs less.
"Why do you consider it to be more fulfilling to be recognized for yourself rather than what you create? Because if it's for what you create, what good it will do you? You will be standing in a room at a party and someone will say, 'Who's that over there?' And the reply will be, 'Apparently he's a famous sculptor.' What good is this?" And people are always saying to me, "Perhaps people want their work to be recognized after their death." What good is that?
Actor John Hurt.
To conclude anything about Quentin, one would have to go to that which is essential, the essence of Quentin. He was a philosopher, and he is the only philosopher, to my knowledge, that actually lived his philosophy. He was a major, major figure of the 20th century, and he wasn't like anyone. He was literally unique.
All my life is given to the world. I don't have a life. I have very few hours in which I'm doing anything except sleeping or being with the world. Now, this I like. I've done it myself, and this is the life that I live.
You have been listening to highlights from the memorial service honoring visionary thinker Quentin Crisp. Thanks to Philip Ward, estate executor and organizer of the Quentin Crisp Foundation, www.crisperonto.org. John Hurt's tape courtesy of Professor Richard Connolly. Additional music composed by Evan Lurie for the film Homo Heights, which co-starred Mr. Crisp. The memorial program to Mr. Crisp was produced by Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials that were used, go online at www.fromthevaultradio.org or call Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producer is Mark Torres. Production coordinator, Edgar Toledo. Outreach by Sean Dellis. Business manager, Mariana Berkovich, and customer service, Arlene Chang. Special thanks to our volunteers, Alan Carmen and Shailendra Shakur. If you're in the Los Angeles area and would like to volunteer for From the Vault, please go to our website to find out how. Our theme music is courtesy of Los Angeles-based Parallel. For more information on Parallel and other music used within the program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.
who? You don't remember me, hey, guess who? You're singing to my song right now. You see that you all have to think for this bird. It's true what they say, the meek shall inherit the earth. I am the freak, I am the fag, I am the widow, one you couldn't stand. I am the geek, I am the nerd, you beat me up when I was 10. So what, I'll play with dolls, I'll play with dolls.
That was called Doll by Kevin Calhoun from his album Doll. This is Queer Voices.
Well, next week is Queer Music Heritage Week.
Yeah, and J.D. will have the fourth in his series featuring transgendered artists in music. And there's just been some incredible work that's been featured this past, past three times.
The work he does is phenomenal. You know, anyone who hasn't taken the time to listen to the program when we do Queer Music Heritage, you should do so. You can also go to his website, queermusicheritage.com. Thank you. and you can get it from his archives there, but definitely listen next week. And we'll see what happens. Who we have on next week?
Well, actually, we should make an announcement that we thought we were going to have the Stonewall.
We thought we were having Remembering Stonewall, and it turned out to be Remembering Quentin Chris, but that was from the KPFT Vault, the archives, and it was a very interesting piece that was someone that I got to meet in my lifetime, and he talked about being a famous queen from England. He was not the only famous queen from England.
Okay.
Yes. And he was kind of, you know, even before Ray Hill. So imagine that.
Yeah, that's pretty old.
And of course,
how can anybody be before Ray Hill?
I know, it doesn't seem possible, but and thanks to Ray for joining us tonight.
Absolutely. It was
great to hear. Always has a story.
Always has a story, and obviously, if you didn't hear all of it or any part of the show, you can go to the archives at kpft.org.
And certainly want to thank Jackie Rear and Ed Barnes for that, talking about Thomas Street and all the good work they're doing over there. It's amazing sometimes when people's lives are touched in such a negative way, the good that can come out of it. And so for Jackie to fulfill her son's wish to remember Thomas Street and do the work there, it was interesting to hear about, and also I hope that it helps some people.
And if your organization would like to come on to Queer Voices, because we try to do cover the community, but occasionally we miss some parts of the community, send us an email, jack@queervoices.org, and we'll try to get you on.
Yeah, we have quite a few things already planned for September and some events that are coming up in October. So we love to let folks know what's going on. September is Alcohol and Drug Addiction Recovery Month, so we're going to have
Something on there, and something near and dear to my heart. I've been clean and sober for 19 years now.
Happy birthday, Jennifer.
Yes, and the world is a lot safer being sober.
You got a card from someone that said happy birthday, and we were like, wait a minute, her birthday's not till October. And they said, you sound like you're always having a birthday, so they must have known.
That's right. Well, that, you know, when you've lived as a guy most of your life, and when you've finally become the woman that you are, it is birthday as it is, you know, it is my birthday every day.
Hey, I went and saw a good movie.
What was that?
Yesterday evening, called Stardust. It has a gay character in it.
Does it now?
Yeah.
Very fun movie, good special
effects.
Not
Michelle Pfeiffer.
There's a real interesting scene, a transgenderizing scene, where one of the wicked witches transforms a guy into a woman for her purposes.
Glenn, there's no such thing as a wicked witch.
That proves
it was a fantasy.
They're just
wickedness is contrary to being
just
a witch.
Well, they're just misguided.
Apparently so.
That's, they have issues.
Such as ourselves, apparently.
I think it's time to go.
Yeah,
I think it is too.
This is Deborah Bell.
And Jennifer
you
Renee.
For
and
Jack Polinsky.
And Glenn Holt.
Queer Voices. See you next week.
You've been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Polinsky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Polinsky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
The Association for India's Development, AID, brings to Houston community a colorful evening featuring Indian classical and fusion dance by Shabana and her troupe. Shabana, a popular dancer and actress from India, has performed all over the globe. The event will feature classical and fusion dance to Western, Caribbean, and flamenco music. The performance will be on Friday, September 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Cullen Performance Hall, University of Houston. AID is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that supports grassroots projects in India in education, health, women's empowerment, and social justice. All proceeds from the event will support these projects. For information about event tickets, visit www.houston.aidindia.org. Again, www.houston.aidindia.org, or call.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.